שלום ליהודים, שלום לבני נוח, שלום גויים. It's the evening of the second day, Kaf Tes Be'iyar Parshas Naso, Tav Shinayin Vav, the evening of the first day, Sunday, 5 June 2016, webcasting from ground zero of planet Earth's leading religious idea, monotheism. Abraham was probably not the first to preach monotheism. The Egyptians' Aton was seen as the one god. What was unique to Avraham was the idea of ethical monotheism, which the Egyptians did not conceive of. They were also obsessed with death and the next life, not at all interested in caring for this world and making it better, tikkun olam. Completing the work of creation, as the circumcision completes the process of birth for a Jew. The religion of the Jews teaches the one God, the Creator, who creates all that is, concluding with his greatest creation, man, whom he plants in the Garden of Eden and sets for him the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Man comes to consciousness via his first lesson, which is that there are such things as good and evil, and God wants him to choose the former over the latter. In this, he is the God of justice, which ancient Egyptians and ancient Greeks and Romans had no notion of. A God who cares about good and evil and prefers one over the other and cares about man's moral life. Abraham's revolutionary vision of God also discovered that he was not pleased with the practice of human sacrifice, which was common for the pre-Jerusalem Jebusites and other Canaanites and the Aztecs and surely other pre-Columbian cultures. No, Abraham's God did not want man to sacrifice other men to him. He is a God of mercy, a far cry from the Greek notion of gods. And how do we know all this? Because this is the story of Abraham's binding of his son Isaac for a practice that God stops. And where did that take place? Where the Jews' temples stood. But since the 8th century, most of it has been buried beneath the Muslim Dome of the Rock. It's called that because it is a great slab of a rock there, which reminded the invading Muslims in the year 638 of the great rock in their hometown in Mecca that had been a pilgrimage site for Arabs from time immemorial before Islam that Muhammad overran and destroyed. Today, what is called the Kaaba, philologically related to the word cube, is a four-story high cube covered by an immense blanket of black velvet that stands in the middle of the open-air Colosseum-type Grand Mosque in Mecca, and it's believed to contain a meteorite that pagan Arabians worshipped before the age of Muhammad. Islam teaches that there were 365 idols placed on this object that Muhammad destroyed, all of them, after he had the insight that the Jews were so much more advanced than his own people, maybe their anti-idolatry philosophy was the right one. I like to think those 365 idols stood for 365 different days, meaning there was no consistency to life. Every day was ruled by a different and capricious pagan god. Anyway, Muhammad destroyed all these idols, and in further learning from the Jews, he taught the Muslims that they must pray in the direction of Jerusalem, just like the Jews. He seems to have thought that his victory, his growing strength as a killer, would persuade them, the Jews, that he was their savior, their next and final prophet. He was the continuation of Judaism. Only the Jews knew who he was and rejected him, which surely hurt his feelings. And so, after a year, he changed his mind, told his followers to stop praying towards Jerusalem, but pray in the direction of Mecca. And it's been that way ever since. Nonetheless, the conquering Muslims, 6 years after Muhammad's death, decided to build the Dome of the Rock on the site of the ruined Jewish temples as a monument to their own triumph, their dispossession of the Jews' holy site. Now it belonged to them, which is what Allah wanted. And that's why today in Jerusalem, 1,378 years later, there was a massive Israeli police presence to protect the thousands of Jews come to celebrate the miracle of the return of the Jews to the Temple Mount in 1967. And the police made it known that they wanted the celebrations to end on time, that is, before sundown, when the Muslims would begin their Ramadan, their daily half-fasts for like 40 days, the very concept of which, a half-fast, these desert brigands stole from the Jews, our notion of the sun-up to sundown fast. We have four of them. And thanks to an anti-Jew of Jewish extraction, the apotheosis of the new Jew, the new Israeli, the Sabra, Moshe Dayan, the post-religious Zionist, the Muslims are the religious masters of the Mount to this day. 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., I think every day, I think Muslims can ascend the Mount and pray or picnic or play soccer. Well, Jews are limited to a few hours, and not every day, I think, but most important, the Jews are forbidden to pray when they ascend the Mount, and they are watched by Israeli police, who will arrest you if they see your lips moving. No kidding. So here is this paradox. On Jerusalem Day, celebrating the return to sovereignty in Jerusalem for the first time in 1967, since the year 63 BCE, we remain barred from our holiest site. And in a way, that makes sense. Moshe Dayan, so fearless in battle, he was spooky, and a notorious skirt chaser, and of course, wholly not religious, was right in 1967 in his universe to order that the Israeli flag placed atop the Dome of the Rock by jubilant Israeli warriors be taken down, and the Waqf informed that they would remain the owners of the Temple Mount as under Jordanian rule, and it would remain an exclusively Muslim religious site. Israel would be the sovereign over the whole city, but provide security for the Temple Mount, which would remain Muslim, not Jewish, as a religious place. Truth be told, in years to come, Jews did ascend the Mount individually and pray with no disturbance, for initially in the years after the Six-Day War, especially the Arabs were very meek, as mice. This business of no praying for Jews is a later development, I don't think until the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Anyway, Dayan's decision made perfect sense in his universe of post-religious native Jews who do not live Jewish, that is, religious lives. Their movement, the leading movement in secular Zionism, and even their rivals in the revisionists, who were also post-religious, none foresaw building a Jewish, that is, a religious state. Theirs was a nationalist movement modeled on the nationalist movements in 19th century Europe. Jabotinsky knew all about the process of unification in Italy and in Germany. One unified in 1870, the other in 1871. Theodor Herzl was raised in this era as a so-called Reform Jew, the second generation of that movement, which was all about stripping oneself of its distinctively Jewish beliefs and behaviors. It was not coincidentally in the wake of the 18th century Enlightenment, which is a euphemism for the loss of faith in Christianity in Europe. And if the Christians became debunkers, why not the Jews too? And so Moshe Dayan, born in 1914 or 15, remembered as the first baby, born in the first socialist kibbutz, though there are those who dispute that, he went on to become the Judah Maccabee of the age, reborn in the mold of King David, the fighter, killer, and adulterer. Only unlike David, who believed in the one God, Dayan was raised to ridicule religion, and he asked that the Israeli flag be taken down. And that was making a statement about his Israel. Religion is stupid, and we're not going to fight over it. If it means so much to the Muslims, let them have it. That was his philosophy. It was the same spirit that allowed his successor, as a great warrior, raised in an atheist commune, Ehud Barak, who in 1999 allowed the Muslims to loot the Temple Mount, carting off truckloads, thousands of tons of dirt containing who knows how many Jewish artifacts. Barak did nothing about this. And how ironic. Dayan was famous for his thievery, for stealing archaeological finds found in the soil of the land of Israel, which is against the law, when he himself, Dayan, mocked the very idea of being a Jew. And here was Ehud Barak allowing the Muslims to throw Jewish archaeological treasures onto a garbage heap. Lecha yolamim Habina veha berachah Lecha
כבוד לחי עולמי, הלקח והליבוב לחי עולמי, המלוכה והממשלה לחי עולמי, הנוי והנצח לחי עולמי, הסיגוי והסגב לחי עולמי, העוז והענבה לחי עולמי, הפדות והבאר לחי עולמי, הצבי והצדק לחי עולמי, הקריאה והקדושה לחי עולמים, הארון והרוממות לחי עולמים, השיר והשבח לחי עולמים, התהילה והתפארת לחי עולמי.
So today was Jerusalem Day, with the parades and dancing and flags and singing, and as of early evening, no news of disturbances. As the Muslims head into their Ramadan month of fasting, the Prime Minister has been firm in denying Jewish rights to pray on the Temple Mount, because I think he knows the truth, that beneath his own bluffing about statehood for the Ancient Ones, the nuclear core of this conflict is religion. The Temple Mount is what it's all about, and he knows it. As I wrote in my book, the invention of the Palestinian was only partially an enemy invention. It never would have succeeded without Israeli cooperation. For the ruling class here, in the decades between the Six-Day War and the fall of Mapai, after almost 30 years in power as a one-party rule state, basically, in 1977, they wanted a parallel nationality to the Israeli nationality, which is different from the Jewish nationality, a religious corporate identity. As Tzipi and Dr. Joseph said, we can't solve a religious conflict, so let's call it a political clash, which would be amenable to compromise and a solution. But I think Bibi knows the score. He knows his history. His father was a historian. In 1929, it was lying about Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Mufti that lit the fuse then and led to 3 days of Jew killing, 137 murdered. Sharon's walk by that same mosque in 2000 ignited the Second Intifada, named for Al-Aqsa. If you want the entire Muslim world massing troops against Israel, do something stupid on the Temple Mount, and I think Bibi knows that. So I'm for denying all Jewish rights to visit the Temple Mount, accompanied by the annexation of Judea and Samaria, precisely because the Muslims are incapable of of allowing us to visit our holiest site in peace. There has to be a price for their behavior. And I would use the power of the Temple Mount in our favor. Anyway, the Prime Minister had a victory on Friday when, after weeks of trepidation here in Israel, that these dozens of anti-Jew states would gather in Paris and give us a deadline to hand back the land they think we stole from the Palestinians. The upshot was a meeting in Paris on Friday that turned out to be 29 states, and which was, in Yiddish, gulnisht. It was nothing but they issued a milquetoast statement in support of the one and only two-state solution, and smeared it with nonsense about the need to, quote, rebuild trust between the parties. Trust these people who continue to name the streets and holidays after Jew killers. The statement that all those 29 countries signed off on called for the end of the Israeli occupation and the implementation of the Arab Peace Initiative. The quartet was praised for its key role and blah, 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 blah. The usual pablum with the subterranean anti-Semitism, of course, cloaked in one euphemism after another. As in so many UN resolutions, both sides were implicitly referred to, but only one was specifically, or rather implicitly, indicated. On the one hand, the text spoke of the alarm at ongoing settlement activity. Who do you think they were thinking of at that point? And on the other side, continued acts of violence, but with no indication of who these perpetrators were of this continuing acts of violence. UN resolutions for years played the same game. Statements about a clash between Israel and some terror Arab cultist group. Israel would be named by name, but never the other side. Sort of like a phantom enemy. And that was a technique in Friday's statement, too. The nations assembled signed off on language expressing their, quote, alarm that actions on the ground, in particular continued acts of violence and ongoing settlement activity, are dangerously imperiling the prospects for a two-state solution. Settlement activity versus continued acts of violence by some unknown party. Other than that, it was a big nothing, this gab fest. The Prime Minister took credit for the feebleness of this document versus a more threatening one, but according to Dr. Matt Nindick, PhD, it was Secretary of State John Kerry who was responsible for persuading the French to produce such a non-threatening text. In Nindick's quoted words, Kerry saved Israel's backside in Paris. Perhaps someone in Israel's government should thank him instead of claiming credit. What a creep this guy is. If this declaration calling for a serious international peace conference at the end of the year, this time with Israel and the Ancient Ones participating, if it has any redeeming value, maybe it's its brevity that helps isolate the principal crime of Israel in the minds of mankind at this point in time. And that is apparent in the word occupation, which is like a zip file in a computer. Open it and you can find lots of ideas inside. Occupation sends the message that the land in question is legally the possession of the Arabs, who today call themselves Palestinians, when there is no legal groundwork for such a legal claim. No one before 1967 said this land belonged to a group of Arabs called Palestinians. The use of the word occupation is thus plainly and grievously an error to the detriment of the Jewish people. Like the deicide charge, today's Jews are guilty of stealing land that belongs to another nation. The word occupation implies this guilt. And once again, the ironies and paradoxes of the secular Zionist movement. Israelis like Netanyahu, who wrote a book called A Place Among the Nations, are as responsible as any anti-Semitic goy for the false accusation by refusing to challenge the accusation and defeat the slanderous charges. You combat the charge of theft with a claim of ownership, the right of Jews to live in Judea and Samaria. That was surely part of the League of Nations mandate, which did allow for the amputating of Eretz Yisrael east of the Jordan, with the implication that the rest west of the Jordan would become the Jewish homeland called for by the Palestinian mandate, the Palestine mandate. That text was a mandate to create a Palestine that did not exist under the Turks and make of it a Jewish homeland. And if Judea was not foreseen as part of this new Jewish Palestine, and no part of the territory could be. Israel has to, but never does, make the case that Judea and Samaria are legally ours, and the charge of occupation is as empty as the deicide charge. It's this generation's excuse for hating Jews. You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. You know, the Israelis, that is the ruling elite here, are oblivious to the role they play in fueling the poison of anti-Israel BDS and other anti-Israel BS around the world. On Israeli TV on Saturday, Exley Kudnick, who created his own party, Moshe Kahlon, he's now the finance minister, said, quote, "At the end of the process, there will be two states for two peoples." And on this basis, he asked Buzhi Herzog to bring his party into the coalition. That's Bibi's official position, too, and he's been pushing it lately by saying he's ready for an upgraded Saudi peace plan. As usual, I see the benefit in this policy, but only in the short term, not in the long. Bibi is surely marking time, running out the clock, feeding crumbs to the enemy, selling the deception that he too is ready for a Palestinian state. But the downside is this reinforcing of the myth of Palestinians with rights to a state in Judea and Samaria, of all places. And that only fuels the fire, burning in the black hearts of world anti-Jewry, by admitting Israel is an occupation of land that it does not belong to and is ready to part with. On the other hand, in running out the clock, there is great logic in light of the lead headline on Friday in Makol Rishon. Trump's lawyer and good friend, Orthodox Jew David Friedman, says Trump could be the first president who declares the settlements legal. Which is not true, by the way. Reagan said it, but that's forgotten history. Trump himself has recently shocked people in Israel by saying, we should be building in the settlements. And I say that may be thanks to David Friedman, whose bio in this interview exposes him as 100% behind renewing Jewish life in Judea and Samaria. Now, that would be a major course correction for the U.S., Israel, and the world when the settlements are seen worldwide as the cancerous cause of all the trouble. In this interview with him on Friday, he said, quote, "I spoke with him, Trump, on the subject, and he was quite clear. He's not prepared to call Judea and Samaria conquered or occupied territories." From whom were they conquered? Friedman asked. The other side, meaning Jordan, doesn't want them at all. He's right about that. They gave up their claim in 1988. He continues, quote, "There is no reason to change the status quo after 50 years when on the Palestinian side we have seen no change at all," close quote. He also quoted Trump, saying that the first step toward peace must be the end of incitement. In the PA media, Trump, he said, has seen a recent video showing little children in Gaza how to stab Jews to death. So maybe this factor is also allowing Bibi to take these seeming baby steps toward an agreement with the ancient ones when he knows that simply they cannot produce what Israel demands of them. And today, reacting, I think, to this Makor Rishon piece, Mahmoud Abbas was adamant that there can be no peace with even one settlement left standing and without a 100% return to the 67 lines and without Jerusalem, which nobody, not even Yossi Beilin, would agree to. In the meantime, in addition to the good Paris that gathering of anti-Jew countries produced only pablum, on Friday, J-Post reported that the BDS movement in Spain, where a growing number of cities have formally supported boycotting all Israeli goods, there's also a counter-movement of opponents, Spaniards fighting for Israel. For example, in the city of Langreo, a population 43,000, which is in Asturias in the north, the city council recently passed a resolution boycotting Israel and anyone, any person or company that supports the Jewish state. In response, this NGO called ACOM, we're not told what this acronym stands for, filed a lawsuit against the city council and won in court. It claimed the legislation brings on discrimination and is tantamount to inciting hate crimes. And not surprisingly, we found out the city council is run by Izquierda Unida, meaning the United Left Party. And plus, there's also an official communist party in charge, I guess a coalition, and an extreme leftist party called Podemos, meaning we can. The report also said Podemos has been under scrutiny by the media for being funded by, take a guess, Iran and Venezuela. In fact, Podemos has used its funding to take control of some 40 localities, including Spain's three largest cities, Madrid, Barcelona, and Valencia. So it is good news. There's a pro-Israel group in Spain, but bad news, if this is an accurate report, that Podemos is that strong, which makes some sense. Spain suffers from an intolerably high unemployment rate, which makes the country ripe for radical right and radical left skullduggery, not to mention its centuries of Roman Catholicism. On the other hand, it was reported on Friday that foreign investment in Israel has reached an all-time high, which makes of the BDS movement so far a flop. Okay, that's it for this very hot first night of the week, the celebration of 49 years of Jewish rule in Jerusalem, which is not quite complete. I'll be back, God willing, on Tuesday. Until then, Laila Tov, Me'eretz Yisrael.